It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Much of the nation's attention has been focused on the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri. The fatal shooting of a young African-American man by a police officer has led to riots, looting, and tension between law enforcement officials and the citizenry. Pitt Law Professor David Harris is here to evaluate the police department's response to the incident, why it went wrong, and what could happen next. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Good to be with you, Paul.
Let's start by getting up to date on the current status of the case. There is a St. Louis County case, and there is a federal investigation into the fatal shooting of this young African-American man.
That's right. There are two parallel investigations, both of the same incident. The St. Louis County prosecutor at the state level is investigating whether or not the shooting of the young man, which is not in doubt, but the status of that. Is it a homicide? Is it considered a murder? Is there enough evidence at this point to charge a crime and take it forward to trial? The federal investigation is ongoing as well. The federal government looks for not only was there a shooting, was force used that was excessive, and was it a homicide, but also did the officer act under color of law to deprive the young man of his constitutional rights? In other words, in the federal scheme, they have to prove more. It's actually a higher burden of proof for the federal prosecutors. But the two investigations running at the same time, different law enforcement agencies, FBI in the federal, local police in the state, this is something that goes on in a case like this pretty regularly.
And why a federal investigation in addition to a state investigation?
Because what you have here is not just the killing of one person by another, but the killing of a person by an agent of the state, a police officer. And when there is suspicion that the police officer has gone beyond his usual privilege to use force, even deadly force, in a reasonable way. They have that privilege under the law. If there is a suspicion that the police officer has gone beyond that privilege and has done so in a way that deprives somebody of their constitutional right to life without due process, that is also a federal crime. More must be proved, but that's how that thing works. And so we have, just like in the Rodney King case years ago, you have a state crime, which of course we remember not guilty verdicts. Then they went into federal court for a federal crime.
If the officer in this case is charged, how likely is a conviction?
Well, if the officer is charged, and that's a big if, I have to say, despite what we all think we know, we don't know a lot. And like I said, the police officer has the right, and in some cases the duty, to use force to effectuate the job. If the police officer is charged, it is very difficult to get a conviction of a police officer in criminal court. Why? Because usually when people go to court and they sit as jurors, the police officers are the good guys. Most times the police get the benefit of the doubt, as they should. So when you go into court with the police officer in the defendant's chair, it effectively turns the world upside down, and it's a difficult switch for most people to make. Number two, sometimes when you go into court against a police officer, the victim in a shooting, for instance, might not be squeaky clean, and that seems to affect the jury as well. Number three is that police officers are seen as a sort of the emblem of the community. That makes them very hard for the jury to convict. And number four, if it's a federal case, you get that higher burden of proof. It's much harder to do it in federal court than in state court.
And if we're saying here that the idea or the likelihood of the officer being charged is a long shot, then what is the goal for the investigators at this point? What are they trying to find out?
Well, I don't know if I would say it's a long shot, but it's an open question. And because the officer has the privilege of using force, the fact that he killed Michael Brown is not enough by itself, as it would be for you or I, to get the thing started. So the goal of the investigation is, first, what happened. There were many witnesses. The officer has his own version of events, we hear. And so without a recording an audio and video recording, we have to figure out whose story squares up with the physical evidence. That's why these autopsies are so important. That's why the angles of the various gunshots are so important. It's not in question who did it or what weapon was used or the fact that a gun was used. It's a question of whose statements square up best with the physical evidence. And maybe one, maybe the other, we can't judge yet. So that's number one. If there is evidence that a crime has been committed, they will charge the gentleman from the police department. They will go forward in a trial. The goal overall is to do fair and impartial justice. And that's a very, very critical thing here because we know from the reaction we've seen, the reaction that came immediately after the incident, there is grave distrust of the police and the justice system in that community. It's one of the reasons that people got so angry so quickly. And it makes it imperative to do a thorough, fair, and ultimately transparent investigation so that when the results come out, people can accept them.
And you've brought up a lot of basic questions here that people are frustrated about because they haven't been answered. When will we get some answers? How long is this investigation going to take?
Well, it could take months. I mean, there's no
months.
Yes, there is no shortcutting doing a thorough job. You have a lot of probing around, maybe forensic evidence, certainly the autopsies, and then you have to talk to absolutely every witness who might know something. There is a lot to look at. And then there's a series of judgment calls that any prosecutor has to go through. Prosecutors are not supposed to take cases forward unless they believe they have the evidence to prove the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Sometimes that's tougher in some cases than others. So this could take a while, and that's not what anybody wants to hear, of course. I mean, there's no patience for a long wait. People want some kind of a result now. They wonder why the officer hasn't been arrested. The reason he hasn't been arrested is because, unlike a civilian, he has the privilege under the law to use force reasonably and in the right situation. So the whole case now is focused on whether or not that was true.
If you have a comment or question relating to what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We're going to look into some of the questions that this case has raised and how it might apply to a situation in Pennsylvania. Email address ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Again, our phone number, 412-246-2002. David, you are among those saying that the police made a number of mistakes in this case. What were some of the most critical mistakes that were made?
Well, obviously, the shooting itself may have been the biggest mistake of all, but we don't know yet. If we go beyond that, there were several serious mistakes in the aftermath. Number one, when demonstrations popped up and people were angry and there was even some minor sorts of violence on those first days, the tack that local authorities took was to bring in this heavy weaponry, this military-grade sets of vehicles, weapons, the body armor and so forth for the police officers that had them looking like soldiers. It was a kind of shock and awe. You know, that we bring in overwhelming force, people will be intimidated. That was a huge mistake because when you start facing people with overwhelming firepower not appropriate to the situation, they go, what in the heck is this? They get scared, they get tense, they get resentful. And it made the situation much worse. It simply inflamed the whole crowd. And made things much, much worse. And this escalated over the following several days into the end part of last week. It was on Thursday that the governor removed the local police from meeting the demonstrations and put in the State Highway Patrol. That was a good move, a new set of people, a different philosophy, and Captain Ron Johnson from the Highway Patrol came in. He marched with the protesters. The protesters were protected. We didn't have a perfect night that last Thursday, but certainly things calmed down. The next morning, Friday of last week, the local police announced they still had not announced anything about the shooting. No facts. They came out, they gave the name of the officer, and then a long report about an unrelated robbery of which Mr. Brown was suspected. This outraged the community and started it all over again.
Right. Let's talk about that. There was this, at first, release of a report. It made it look as if robbery had something to do with the shooting. And police were later forced to admit the contrary.
That's right. On that day, that was last Friday, August 15th, the police released a 19-page report about this robbery of a convenience store and a videotape that purports to show Michael Brown taking some tobacco products and pushing the man inside the store. Yet they released no information about the shooting itself except the name of the officer. And they were later – the implication there, of course, was that this was what the police were responding to when Michael Brown was shot. Well, they were later forced during the day to say – that's not why this police officer stopped Michael Brown. He stopped him because he was walking in the street, and that's what led to this shooting.
Now, was this done intentionally by the police to mislead people into thinking, hey, this officer might have been justified in doing what he did, or was it an honest mistake?
I can't be in that police chief's head. None of us can, but it is almost impossible to believe that knowing what that chief knew, that it had nothing to do with Michael Brown's shooting, to release that at the same time
would mislead people.
It would mislead people. It was at the very least intended to give a much different picture of Michael Brown than he's just a victim. Makes him out to look much, much different. Now, of course, even if he had robbed a convenience store, you can't kill him. But that point was lost on everybody. It was an attempt at the very least to change the narrative in a negative way towards Michael Brown.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with David Harris. Let's see. Marty from Beaver County was on the line. He couldn't stay on, but his question is, quote, why are they always bashing the police? Crime committed by percentage of population, police know where crimes occur, not racial profiling. It's a little cryptic there, but the basic question he's asking is, why are they always bashing the police? He seems to believe that the police are trying to protect those in the community and that they're getting a bad rap here.
Well, I understand the basis of Marty's question. A lot of what I've heard in the days since this very tragic incident has been anti-police. But what's going on here is not at least on everybody's part, a bashing of the police. The police are there to protect the good people in the community. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But what I think has been on display is a sort of years of very deep anger at mistrust and mistreatment by these local police. People don't forget that stuff. And when an incident like this happens, lots of these things pour out. It may be, as Marty implies, that there is greater there's a greater proportion of criminal acts committed by any particular racial or ethnic group in any one town. And maybe Ferguson, maybe it's true there. But that does not really mean that you would simply target that population. If you do that, you're overwhelmingly going to be targeting good people, not bad people. So it's a question of the right kind of police tactics. You want the community on your side in addressing the bad folks, not aligned against you because they're all treated alike.
412-246-2002 is the number to call. Let's go to Rich in Shaler. Rich, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Am I on?
You are on, Rich. Welcome to Essential
Hi.
Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you were asking Professor Harris about to make a comment about the police response. And as I recall, because I was watching this on the internet that afternoon, early that evening, you know, that we had public mourners grieving in the street, not really posing a threat. And as you pointed out, Professor Harris, they're met with this military response. And I was asking myself the same question, what's going on here? And one idea I had was, well, since the police know that the likelihood of a conviction is very low, aren't they preparing for the day when that arrives, that the community will understand that there will be no criminal liability for Darren Wilson, and there will be further outrage. And this is the response that they can expect.
Well, Richard, that's an interesting point. And David, in addition to what Rich is saying, isn't part of the police response to, or at least what we've been hearing, what the pundits are telling us is that this is part of the post-9/11 world, and that police departments, big and small, have been beefing up on military arms and military-style weaponry and protection that makes them look less like the guardian and more like the warrior in these situations.
Well, both of these are great points. To Rich's question, I wouldn't guess. I don't think that the police were thinking ahead to the day when the eventual verdict comes down and assuming it would be not guilty. I saw a lot of short-sighted thinking, no planning, no awareness of how what they were doing either looked or affected people around them. So I can't imagine that they were actually thinking that far ahead. But to your larger point, Rich, and to yours too, Paul, in the post-9/11 environment, we have given millions, billions of dollars out through the Department of Justice and Homeland Security Department for the purchase of this military equipment. And the Pentagon has had a parallel program moving this equipment out of the military and into the hands of civilian law enforcement. Now, the purpose, the stated purpose of this was to fend off and handle circumstances of terrorist attacks. Now, we have had terrorist attacks in this country. We had 9/11. Last year, we had an attack at the Boston Marathon. Sometimes that kind of response might be called for. So in a very unlikely situation, it is possible that in St. Louis County, Missouri, you could need an armored personnel carrier. But it is so unlikely that what you got to do is keep it in the garage. And when you have that kind of equipment, when you have those big guns, what happens is you're tempted to roll them out and use them in any situation that looks like it might call for it. And the result is you get them out there, you get that equipment out there when it's not appropriate. And it inspires the kind of backlash that we saw. So that is that kind of response, that militarization, I think is very, very much misplaced. And I think we really have to take a hard look at what works. We saw that when the highway patrol went in, they took away that equipment. They went to regular police uniforms, and that calmed the situation. That's what we ought to be thinking of now.
Let's go to Marie in Pittsburgh before we break. Marie, welcome to the program. How are you?
I tuned in a little late, so I didn't hear the qualifications of the individual who's commenting. But as a person with experience in doing criminal trials.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris is our guest.
Okay. Well, then we're in the same field. But here's what I want to say with regard to the release of the film. There is, if you recall,
you're talking about the video surveillance of Michael Brown in the convenience store.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Did it have anything to do with the event? No. However, he was being described, and if you can put yourself in the perspective of this police officer, as a gentle giant. I remember that word being bantered about several times. In fact, what was shown with the release of that film was that that was an individual with an extremely violent propensity. As I recall, that was a tiny little person, man or woman, compared to him that was being beaten up and who was being robbed. And so although I don't think it justifies the subsequent shooting, he actually did have a violent propensity, and that could very well be brought in at trial in terms of, you know, what they're saying. He didn't attack the officer. Was he pulled into the car, or did he reach into the car?
Right,
but
right.
As far as his character, nobody's assassinating it. What's being done is the truth of the person is being shown very accurately.
Okay, well, Marie, let me jump in, because I think that your point is well taken. I don't know necessarily that video showed anybody being beaten up, but certainly it seems to indicate that a crime was being committed, and that Michael Brown was perhaps not necessarily the gentle giant that he was portrayed as. However, was it appropriate to Marie's question? Was it appropriate to put that video out there in terms of the timeliness in which it was done by the police?
I can't agree with Marie. I think as a trial lawyer, she probably knows that we do not allow propensity evidence to come in most cases. That's the rules of evidence in almost every state that I can think of. It's certainly what I teach in the evidence classes. As far as his character, we know that one incident does not a person's character make. But more importantly than any of that is the fact that there is no facts, nothing to show that this officer would have known that, and therefore it should have affected his reactions to Michael Brown. All he knew of Michael Brown was whatever happened in front of him and between them. And that's the thing that counts, not something else he did.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and our guest is Pitt Law Professor David Harris. We are talking about the situation and the unrest and residual questions about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, and how they might apply to us in Pennsylvania. And we will also focus on the laws in Pennsylvania about disclosure and how they compare with those in the state of Missouri. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about the fatal shooting of a young African-American man by a police officer in Missouri, the questions that case has raised about police conduct, and the selective release of information about the shooting. One of the questions we'll look at in this segment is, if this happened in Pennsylvania, what would the laws have forced government agencies to do? What information would they be required to disclose under the law? 412-246-2002 is the number to call to join the conversation. The email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, and on Twitter at esspgh. Follow the conversation at #EPLive. Let's go to the phones. We have Anthony, who's been waiting in Lawrenceville. Anthony, welcome to the show. Hello, Anthony.
I was calling because it seems no matter what these police officers do, from Rodney King to Johnny Gamage to Amadou Diallo, they shoot and kill unarmed people, yet they're never punished time and time again. It seems as though they can commit murder with impunity and never punished.
David, what about Anthony's question that the officers are never held to account for some of these actions?
Well, I wouldn't say they're never held to account. Using Anthony's own examples, in the Rodney King case, it took two different trials, but the officers ultimately were held to account and went to prison. As we were talking about earlier, it is simply very, very difficult to prove a criminal case against a police officer for all the reasons we listed before. There are other ways that police officers are held to account. There is internal discipline. They can at times be fired. Other things can happen too. So the picture of being held to account is a little broader than that. But, these things are complicated. They are not easy. The legal system is not the only way we should address these problems. We have to think in terms of what kind of policing we want in this country, what we will demand as citizens, and the police need to think, what kind of relationship do they want with their communities? Because if they are in a position of being opposed to their communities instead of partners with their communities, they operate with one hand tied behind their backs when we try to have safety and public order, and that's in nobody's interest.
Let's go to Sam in Monroeville. Sam, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
My question is this. I've had a lot of background in hand-to-hand combat and a lot of training and various things, and I've trained with lots of police, and I know what these guys' basic skill set is. I'm always curious why the base response is always to go for the gun. They have batons, they have hand-to-hand skills, and yet, when they encounter somebody with a knife or something like that, they always shoot. They never seem to shoot the wound, and they always shoot to kill, and I don't understand that.
That's a great question, Sam. Here's the answer. Police look at the use of force on a continuum, everything from pulling you to come along, called a come along hold, to less than lethal actions such as hitting with a stick or pepper spray or a taser, all the way up to deadly force. They're not allowed to use more force than is reasonably necessary. But here's the thing. When they get to a point where they are facing a deadly threat, somebody else pointing a gun, somebody else pointing a knife at them, and the person advances on them, perhaps won't obey commands to drop the weapon. They are trained to neutralize the threat. Neutralizing the threat means you have to stop the person. They are not trained to shoot to wound. They are trained to shoot to kill, but only facing a deadly threat. So the question in the Michael Brown case will be whether it was necessary to use deadly force. I have heard many, many times, not just in this case, but many other times, why didn't the police use a taser? Why did they have to kill that man? Well, sometimes that question has a real basis. Other times, there's a misapprehension here. Tasers are not a substitute for a firearm. A firearm is only supposed to be used for deadly force. If you used a taser facing deadly force, you could not guarantee that the person would stop or give up, because after 5 seconds, they can continue to get up. It's very unpleasant, I can tell you that personally, but it isn't the same thing as a firearm. So everything has to have a reasonable place.
And we still don't know for sure.
Absolutely.
If that officer
we don't know.
Faced deadly force.
We do not know. That's worth emphasizing.
And there's been renewed interest in body-mounted cameras being worn by police
yes.
officers, which you would think would help in a case like this. What can you say about the usefulness of that for situations like the Michael Brown case?
Paul, I'm a big proponent of body-worn video and audio recording systems. These are relatively new. They came online and were tested first in the UK in about 2008, 2009. There has now been field training and testing on them in the United States. No technological fix is a silver bullet. It doesn't solve all problems. But if you had body-worn video, and these are very small units that clip on either like a Bluetooth headset or like a little sort of a box on the officer's collar or tie or something, you would at least have a recording from a head's eye view of what the officer is seeing, what they're reacting to, and what the situation was like. That would remove a lot of the questions that we are left with after a case like Michael Brown's case. Now, what we have to actually have in order to make these systems work and ensure accountability with them, so there has to be rules that they will be turned on each and every time there's a citizen police encounter. Otherwise, they will just serve very narrow purposes.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris and, again, 90.5 WESA. David, how has the selective release of information about the shooting, especially the anonymity at first granted to the officer who shot Michael Brown, how has that affected this case?
I think it's had a really negative effect. Now, I have to say, most police departments will not release the identity of the officer involved in a police shooting unless there are charges. That is common. That's the way it works here in Pittsburgh. That's my understanding. But what can happen is police may release other details. They may release whatever it is they know that they feel comfortable giving out. And you know, it's an ongoing investigation. They have to be careful. They can't give out anything, but they are allowed to release whatever level of detail seems appropriate. And it is important to the people in the public who are concerned with whatever incident it is to get some information, to have some degree of transparency, because as we have seen, there is often distrust of law enforcement, and no information feeds rumors, makes the distrust worse, gets people upset. Why can't we know anything? The contrast between the Ferguson incident and a shooting in St. Louis just this week could not have been starker. Whatever you want to say about that St. Louis shooting, the police gave out information right away, same day, audio, video, the police 911 calls, everything. The police chief went to the scene, talked to the people there. If you're somewhat more transparent, as much as you can be, it will go a long way towards getting people to accept the eventual outcome of the investigation.
In Missouri, the legal groups who teamed up with community leaders to press for information about the officer who shot Mr. Brown cited that state's Sunshine Law. If this had happened in Pennsylvania, what would the laws have forced government agencies to do?
Well, Pennsylvania has a pretty good right to know law. It was changed just a few years ago, and it's a pretty good one as those things go. Now, there is an exemption in there for anything involving an ongoing police investigation. So under Pennsylvania's law, the police would not be obligated to release anything under the right to know law. But here's the thing. Sometimes you can stand on your legal position and do yourself harm. If the police are playing it smart, what they do is they release whatever detail they can, given the case, given what they know, and given the progress of the investigation. You don't want to jeopardize the investigation, but you release what you can, even though you don't have to release anything. And it shows that you're trying to do everything you can to let people know what happened, to keep the situation calm, and to treat the citizens like the people that they are.
Is there a federal constitutional right under the First Amendment to information about government activities, including internal police reports?
Well, there's a Freedom of Information Act, of course, a federal law, but that also contains an exemption for, if I'm remembering this right, for ongoing investigations. There is a First Amendment right to cover public trials and things like that, but there is, generally speaking, no right that I know of to have information that might jeopardize safety or public order. So that's why Attorney General Holder, in his meetings yesterday, said, you know, there's just some things I'm not prepared to talk about or say right now. We'll release that information when it's appropriate. Here's what I can tell you.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris joining us to talk about the situation, the case in Ferguson, Missouri, and some of the implications or similarities that we might learn from as they apply to other states like Pennsylvania. David Harris, as always, great thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be with you, Paul. Thank you.
Coming up, how a Pittsburgh-based organization is helping to provide medical aid in areas of Western Africa affected by the Ebola outbreak. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.